This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, where a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. And what I believe is our 8th annual food trend show, we have Michael Whiteman in studio to talk about all things 2019. We touch upon rising menu costs, getting sweet on sour, and this year's 2019 buzzwords. So sit back, relax, and here's another episode of Snacky Tunes.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz, sitting across from Michael Whiteman. Our eighth year together.
We're going steady.
I mean, we're officially, this is officially a thing.
I know people will talk.
They will say things. Thank you again for writing such a wonderful trend report. It is a joy to read every year. It is our cheat sheet. We sound super educated for all the dinner parties to come.
Well, I've discovered that you're my audience of one.
Oh, well, there's two of us. Darren's just, out in L.A. So we're going to start at the beginning. What you have kind of touched on over the years is a discrepancy in how people eat, where it used to be people stayed home more, cooked more, then there was explosion of restaurants and people went out, and now we're starting to see change, and we're starting to see a high-low. What is happening?
Well, first thing that's happening is that not everybody in the country is rich, and not everybody in the country has gotten rich. Despite the government shutdown, there are other trends that are equally important. The price of eating out has been going up rapidly for several years now, and we've talked about it in a previous show. The price of food is going up faster than the price of eating food at home. So at some point, when the pocketbook begins to pinch, you look at how much it's going to cost to go out and how much it's going to cost to pick up food at Kroger and bring it home. And the answer is that more and more people are bringing food home. The fact of the matter is that statistics show that about half of our food dollar is spent on food away from home. It's a shaky statistic, because the fact of the matter is that about 80% of the meals in the country are eaten at home.
Right.
Okay, so the swing has to do with the fact that it's much more expensive to eat out. And the big cost right now is not how much a pound of hamburger meat costs. The big cost difference right now for the restaurant industry is the cost of labor.
Right. I mean, for those who have not been paying any attention, the average minimum wage is going up in major cities, and other cities have either followed suit or are in trend in the next few years or 3 to 5 years to also hit a 15 or a common or something similar, depending on the market and the city that they're in.
Well, Amazon all by itself has set the national minimum wage rate. Amazon has announced they're going to be paying $15 an hour this year. Walmart just announced that its truck drivers will be getting close to $90 an hour because there is a labor shortage. If you look at a restaurant and then look at a supermarket, in a restaurant you see lots of people. Mm-hmm. In a supermarket, go find somebody to tell you where the canned peas are.
I can't.
Okay. So every time the minimum wage goes up, it affects restaurants a lot more than it does supermarkets.
You've also talked in the years past, which you can go to our archives and listen to, about a glut of restaurants. So there was a time when there were so many restaurants opening, and it was obviously not going to be sustainable. Do you see this as kind of one of the reckonings of getting back to the correct amount of restaurants or some type of balancing out, because it just has to be that way?
The U.S., unlike other countries, suffers from two forms of selling things to people. One is there are too many restaurants, and second, there are too many retail stores. And third, as you know, there are too many shopping centers. So retail stores are closing left and right. say hello, say goodbye to Sears. Restaurants are also closing, but not at that rapid rate. The unfortunate situation is that restaurants' prices are too low because wages have been held down, and that's ending. And as restaurants are forced to raise their prices, I think we're going to see a fair number of them closing.
But you also mentioned that there's a new type of restaurant that's filling the gap, this type of fast cash and fast casual that is not a Sweetgreen, which is not a Shake Shack, but is actually what you might have seen as a restaurant, which is less people, more streamlined service, people are going to get their own things. Where do you see this filling the gap, and why do you think that this is catching on?
That's an interesting question, and it's an interesting phenomenon. The chains that you just mentioned, the Sweetgreens and the Shake Shacks and the Five Guys and that group, formed an area of food service called fast casual. And the idea was that you could go to these places and spend a bit more money and get a little slower service, but you get a lot better food because the food would be fresher. And the contrast was, if you go to McDonald's, you don't get food, you get a package. If you go to Sweetgreen, you order a salad, and then you talk to the waiter and the person who's assembling it, and you have control over your food, and you see it being put together. So this was supposed to be a step up from fast food. As it is developing, the point you're making, as it's developing, we're finding that restaurants, casual restaurants who are feeling the same labor pinch as everybody else, are looking for ways to wash out as much labor as possible. So they're taking the idea of the service at Chipotle Grill or Sweetgreen, those are my two favorite examples, and making the food even better. So they're now serving restaurant food in a Chipotle or a Sweetgreen kind of setting. So there's no waiters. There's no seaters, there's no tablecloths, there's you order at the counter, you pick up your food, you take it, you bus your you bus it, and you're gone. But you've gotten a restaurant quality meal experience. So if fast food is has an average check of, I don't know, make up $5, and Sweetgreen has an average check of $12. We're now looking at places that have average checks of $18, $19, $20, where you're getting a meal that you used to get in the same premises for $40.
And has there been, in your research, what have been customers' reactions? They like it, they don't like it, they feel like it's, you know, it's a weird experience because they're kind of in the middle, or does it all seem to work because of the price point?
It works because of the price point. It works because they're familiar with the system. Mm. Chipotle has made it familiar. Not everybody is going to be happy with this kind of service, but it is providing a opportunity to eat out at a price that prior to that you would look at it and say, we can't afford that this week.
And do you think that these restaurants are built to scale? Like there'll be 10 of these, or are these the same? It's almost the same like these small 44-seat restaurants. This is just the new way they're doing service.
Both. There are some people who had 50 or 60 seat restaurants who have switched to this fast casual kind of service, and it'll just be a one-off because it's an entrepreneurial adventure. But a lot of these, I believe, have traction, are scalable, and could very well be the next wave of restaurant development. And if that's true, then the old legacy restaurant chains are going to be in even more trouble than they are now. I'm talking about things like Red Lobster and Olive Garden and TGI Fridays.
One of the other points you make as well is that it saves in expenses, which I think is an interesting thing to consider. 50% of it is takeaway, so smaller restaurant, less energy, less gas.
That's correct.
So these become financial decisions as well.
And it also straddles the first point you made, which is that more people are eating at home. Now, in this particular case, I might be eating at home, but I had my food delivered or I picked it up from a restaurant. So in that case, the supermarket lost a meal that it could have sold to you if you were taking food home to cook it. The restaurants gained a meal, but in a far more efficient way.
A lot of these things that you're talking about really do come down to economics, and what forces when these things get more expensive is innovation. And one of the things that we're seeing is innovation in AI and robotics for restaurants. One of the things you touch upon are these conveyor-like systems that are starting to pop up either in test markets or people trying to scale them. What are some of the examples you've seen, and how nervous should employees be that they're going to be replaced?
There's an awful lot of investor money going into artificial intelligence and robotics. And it's going, among other areas, into the restaurant industry because there's this labor crunch and labor crisis, and the cost of labor goes up. It becomes more efficient to begin to think about replacing people with robots. San Francisco and China are the two centers of this sort of development. And it's happening also in the hotel business. There are hotels now where room service is delivered to you by a robot. There are hotels where there's nobody at the front desk except people looking robots, avatars, to check you in. And sometimes there's a backup human being just in case something goes wrong. But if you think about your own experience in checking into a hotel, you went online, you pressed a button, you got a reservation. You came to the hotel, there's a kiosk over there in the corner, and you punch your name in and you wave your hand at it, and your room key comes out. And so far, you haven't touched a person. Restaurants are more complicated than that because you have to make a hamburger. You have to put lettuce and tomato on the toast the bun. But people are inventing systems that will automate this process. There's a kiosk on the sidewalk in San Francisco where you walk up and tell it what you want in the way of your coffee in the morning, and a robot makes it. You want a latte, it makes a latte. You want a double espresso, it'll make a double espresso. Not only that, it'll clean the counter after you've picked up your coffee and wiped some of the spill up.
Well, you mentioned that, and you also mentioned Creator, which makes burgers and has 350 sensors and 20 computers. Is it any good? Does it taste right? Is anyone checking for quality? Is it just like approximating quality and approximating taste?
This is a machine that's about 30 feet long, and it has a bunch of cylindrical tubes. All tubes are cylindrical. It has a bunch of transparent tubes, and in those tubes are tomatoes, cheese, hamburger meat. And when you walk up to a kiosk and you say, I want a medium rare hamburger and I want it with lettuce, tomato, and Korean barbecue sauce. And you punch all that into the system, and the machine will slice a bun, toast the bun, grind the meat, grill it, slice the tomato fresh, put it on the meat, put the meat on the bun, put the sauce on it, the whole thing. It tastes like a hamburger.
Yeah. But I mean, I am just so curious. I mean, again, if it's conveyor food in the same way that McDonald's or Burger King is, I'm sure it's of a certain quality, but you have to wonder, you know, if it all switches over to that, does it then just become a game of telephone where no one cooks a hamburger anymore, and it's just like what someone told someone hamburgers tasted like, and now it's just an algorithm. To kind of bring this back full circle, where you said people are staying home more, cooking more, one of the trends that arose over the years of the show is the meal kit and mm-hmm. the at-home kit, where there's now maybe 150, 200 different ones for every paleo, vegan, vegetarian, yes. carnivore.
Yes.
How are they doing?
Lousy. It's a business where it's somewhere between difficult and impossible to make money. And part of that has to do with logistics. You've got to take all these meal components and put them in boxes and then put the boxes in boxes and then make sure they're insulated properly and then have Federal Express deliver them halfway across the country. And then when you get home, you got all this cardboard that you have to get rid of. most of the meal kit companies are losing lots of money. Some have gone under. Others have formed alliances with supermarkets because supermarkets already have the food there. Mm. And supermarket is a place that you go anyway, so you can order a meal kit while you're shopping and bring the meal kit home. So it doesn't have to travel halfway across the country.
Are the meal kits pre-assembled there, or are they assembled at the supermarket?
At the supermarket.
Okay, interesting. Is there one that will survive in the Hunger Games of meal kits? Is there one that will survive?
I would watch Kroger, because it's the most innovative of traditional supermarket companies, and it has made a couple of alliances with meal kit companies. I suspect that the future of meal kits is not Federal Express. I think it's going to be a function of the supermarkets.
Right where food always was.
Which it always was. And there are some restaurants that are just tiptoeing into this sort of business.
If I go to a restaurant and I pay them for a meal kit, I think that would be a bridge too far. Changing topics, you always bring up new flavors and new places that people are bringing food from. So let's start with food from the stands. Kazakhstan, Tajikistan.
My Uncle Stan.
Uzbekistan. What is the flavor profile? Why is that making headway in the States? And what are some of the standout dishes?
Okay, the first is a bigger why. Most of the ethnic food that we eat in this country that is the result of migration. After the Vietnam War, there were huge numbers of Vietnamese and people from what we used to call Indochina. Who migrated to this country for safety reasons. And they began cooking for themselves, as all immigrant groups have. And then their food spilled out beyond their neighborhood borders. And suddenly we've become expert on purple basil and bird chilies. And the same is true with Mexican food. And the same was true with the Jewish deli. So... But the breakup of the Soviet Union, because all of these stands were part of the Soviet Union, with the breakup of the Soviet Union and lots of turmoil in that part of the world, we've seen a lot of immigration of people from Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan and all the other stands. And they're bringing their food with them. You see it most in Los Angeles. And then there's this obscure place called Brooklyn, where there are any number of Uzbeki restaurants opening. It used to be lumped into Middle East Turkish cuisine, and we think of things like kebabs as being the most familiar of the food. These guys have their own versions and flavor profiles, and the part that... I'm interested in is they do a lot of organ meats. They do miraculous things with liver. I would never eat liver, but you would.
I would.
You would.
We're Jewish. We grew up eating liver.
Yeah, I know, and we will.
Yeah.
Also with vast amount of herbs, tarragon, basil, parsley, cilantro, spinach is an herb, are used in with a much heavier hand than we're accustomed to. So the flavor profile changes enormously.
And a few years back when you talked about, the globe on a plate, I think that you see people, just their palates have been exposed to so much, they want these new flavors. Their tongues are tired of the same thing over and over again. So when you get these combinations together, especially these stewed meats, the offals, all these combinations, it's different. It's new for them.
It is. In this case, it's not fusion cooking.
Yeah.
This is genuine ethnic cooking. And for the most part, they're still cooking for themselves. So if you can get to a real Uzbeki restaurant, it will taste like the food an Uzbeki person would eat, Uzbek.
Do you think 50 years from now it'll be like Chinese restaurants where there's like the Americanized Uzbeki and then there's like the off menu that you could order, like how they used to cook it?
I don't think it'll get that far. And there's a good reason for it. There are a lot more Chinese than there are Uzbeks.
Speaking of Chinese, my favorite food, Chinese food, is back on your list, which is great. Szechuan hot pots, dry cooking, and bings, which I had the pleasure of having for the first time last year. So why is Chinese back on your list, and what are these new flavors and these new types of cooking that are making their way?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. I really don't know why Chinese has suddenly come back, except that there is a vast number of contemporary Chinese people living in this country, whether as immigrants or as students. Enormous numbers of students, as they can tell you, at Harvard and Columbia.
And NYU.
And so these people are ready for a new wave of food, and they're not particularly keen on eating what we used to call Chinese-American food. In China at the moment, there is a rage on hot pot cooking. Hot pot cooking is kind of like a fondue with broth instead of a cheese sauce in it. And you get an array of meats and vegetables, and you pick them up with your chopsticks, and you stick them in this broth and cook it to your desired doneness. For some reason, it has become all the rage in China. And there are studies on how many hot pots are being made. But it sloshed over into this country. And so where there are Chinese areas, there are Chinese hot pots. And the ones that are most interesting are the Szechuan hot pots. In a Szechuan hot pot, the broth that you're dipping your food into is already pre-seasoned with a fire alarm's worth of chili peppers and herbs and anise. And so there's a real flavor and a punch in the nose when you cook your food.
Every time I go to a hot pot place, I can smell it on my jacket for like 3 days. I mean, I love it. But it's almost like enveloping all the senses as well.
That, and there's a flame underneath the pot that's getting you warm as well as the food. But there's a shift from this hot pot stuff to what's called dry pot. And that is that instead of you swishing your food around in a tub of liquid, you tell the chef what the ingredients are that you want, and he cooks it. And it ends up with 3 or 4 tablespoons of liquid in the bottom of the bowl. But those 3 or 4 tablespoons of liquid are intense. You toss it like you would spaghetti bolognese, but with a whole new flavor profile and far more exaggeration of what the flavors are.
And what's a good example of some restaurants that are doing it at the highest level?
In New York, you would go to a place called the Ma La Project. There are two. There's one in the East Village, and there's one in Midtown. And they give you a choice of 4 levels of heat. My medical advice to you is not to take the hottest, because I've had the next to the hottest, and it's incendiary.
You pay for it no matter what.
Yeah, you pay for it.
You pay for it no matter what. One of the other things that was such a delight this year is when I was running through the Flatiron and needed something for lunch, I had my first Bing and stopped dead in my tracks. I was like, why have I not had this? This is phenomenal. And also when I was traveling over in London, there was a Bing stand in one of the food markets. For those who are uneducated on it, what is this wonderful delight?
There are 2 forms of Bing. Fundamentally, it's either a flatbread like a burrito, or it's a crepe that's made with an eggy batter on a big heated steel drum, and they're made to order in front of you. The chow bing is one that looks like a burrito, and it's like Chipotle grill. You walk up and you say, I'll have that, I'll have that, I'll have that. I'll have that beef shin with anise flavoring along with...
Yum.
Along with chive ash. And it tastes really authentically Northern Chinese, even though it's taken a fair number of liberties, but you would recognize it immediately as Chinese. And there's a company in New York called Junzi, J-U-N-Z-I. They have one in across the street from Harvard, across the street from Yale, one up near Columbia University, one in Greenwich Village, and a fourth opening near Bryant Park. It was formed by a bunch of Chinese PhD students who won a contest to produce a business plan for a restaurant that didn't exist. And here they are with four. The other one is a company called Mr. Bing, which is probably what you had. That's a big eggy crepe. They make this crepe in front of you, and then they fill it with all sorts of excessively salty and excessively seasoned product, which I think is not as good as Junzi, but they're both opening new places. And, they're fast casual with a new form of cuisine. They're very interesting.
The final flavor profile that you touched on, getting sweet on sour, is the rise of sour foods. Where we had a craving for bitter before, coffee, dark chocolate, Brussels sprouts, now sour is getting into the mix. Why? Where is it coming from? And what are some really prime examples for people who have not had the chance to explore this yet?
Well, for one thing, we're always looking for new flavor sensations. And for the last 15 years, the emphasis has been on bitter, whether it's bitter coffee or broccoli or any of the cruciferous vegetables or the darkest chocolate you can get. So we've kind of used that up. Sour has always been a component of our food that we don't really pay much attention to. If you were having dinner in Southeast Asia, to go back to the area we were talking about before, if you were in Indochina, if you thought about it, you would pick up a lot of sour in the food you're eating, and it largely would come from citrus fruits. We're becoming inundated on both coasts with Philippine food. Because there are a large number of Filipinos in this country, but they've remained pretty anonymous. But like other ethnic groups, they're spilling over their borders. And Philippine cuisine is largely vinegar-based, and it's also largely citrus-based. So we're getting another dose of sour. And the same is true with in a limited number, a group of authentically Iranian restaurants, because we're getting a lot of Iranians in this country. Their food, like the ones from the stands, is heavy on herbs and heavy on sour.
What are some dishes that are prime examples of this that people might have had and not realize that it's falling into this trend?
Oh, ceviche. Every time you've had ceviche, you've had raw fish in lime juice, and the flavoring is the lime. If you go to a really good cocktail bar, you will find that the amount of sweetening in cocktails has been diminished, and the amount of fresh acidic fruits has been accentuated.
I hate a sweet cocktail. Never like them. Sugary sweet cocktail, not for me.
You know, you're not an average American.
No, I know.
You're not even an American.
I like a dark, bitter, amaro-based cocktail. That's for me. So I welcome the sour trend.
By the way, Korean food is also based on fermented food. And the most familiar of which is kimchi, which is as sour as all get out.
We're going to take a quick break, throw to a mid-roll. Jeet's going to step in, do his thing, and then we'll be back with the second half of our 2019 trend show here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Allison Kane, and I'm the host of In the Sauce here on HRN. Now that I'm expanding my cooking school to a sauce line in grocery stores, I need all the help I can get. And I want to help other entrepreneurs build their brands too. You can find In the Sauce wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
The most exciting thing on here for me is, as you put it, cell-based, slaughter-free, culture-clean, lab-grown motherless meat, otherwise known as plant-based meat. You've seen a lot of headlines about it. You've seen the Petri dish, the $40,000 burger. But you've also been seeing a rise in companies that are getting pretty close. I had my first Impossible Burger in August, and I still think about it. I couldn't believe how close the taste was, but I also couldn't believe how good I felt afterwards. Where is this going? What is the future? How soon will cows be safe to roam? Roam.
You touched on two different topics. One is the growth of plant-based meats, which we talked about last year. I said it was 2018 trend of the year, which indeed it turned out to be, except everybody's saying it's 2019. So I was a year ahead.
That's the point of running a good trend report.
I know, the hell with them. The second is what's called lab-grown meat, which I think is equally important to the plant-based meat substitutes that you've been getting, including your Impossible Burger, which is a meat substitute. It's a vegetable product that's been manipulated to a fairly well so that it tastes like a hamburger. It's pretty good. The idea of what we're calling it motherless meat is that you pluck a cell from a chicken or a cow, and you grow the cell in a laboratory under conditions that are more complex than you and I can ever understand. And eventually, you get meat. And you haven't killed an animal because you've grown the meat in a lab. And there are companies in Europe, Israel, and the U.S. that are getting huge amounts of investor dollars and working on this. The first one to market is a what you would call, it looks like ground chicken. And it's being tested in a Kentucky Fried Chicken somewhere in England, but they won't tell you where. And all the rest of this is stuff that's coming down the pike, maybe this year or next year. It could be 15 years before they get something that tastes like a steak. But it could be 5 years that it looks like a steak. And the implications of this are profound. If you can grow meat to scale in laboratories from cells, from animals and chicken, and by the way, people are doing it with fish too, you don't need ranchers because all you need is cells. If you don't need ranchers, you don't need acres full of cows and pigs and chickens dropping their poop into the ground and polluting your streams and also pooping up the air and filling the air full of global warming gases. So that's a big change. I mean, you can look at half of the country being turned back to forest.
What people don't understand that red meat is one of the largest causes, and meat consumption itself, to climate change.
That's correct.
They think it's transportation, but it's really that, and also the sheer amount of energy. Now, do you have a sense of how much energy goes into growing lab-based meat versus growing a cow or raising pigs?
There are estimates. I don't have them. I do have them, but I don't have them with me. That was a trick question. The differences are quite profound, especially in terms of energy use and water. because it takes vast amounts of water to grow a calf into a cow in order to make a steak.
It's fascinating. And there are people who are detractors. Besides the people who don't want to eat their meat in lab, farmers are rightly scared. And what are some of the tactics that they're taking to battle against this? And they have precedent from the rise of oat milk versus standard milk.
That's correct. There is a... I think it's the state of Missouri just passed... If it's not Missouri, it's Mississippi or something else with an M. Just passed a law that you couldn't call anything meat unless it came from something that had four legs. This was obviously forced on the legislature by the meat people. But the big protein selling companies in this country who traffic in meat and chicken are also investing in the same lab-grown meat ventures because, A, they need to hedge their bets, and B, this could be the next thing.
You hear these laws and it's like, you know, you just, people, instead of understanding progress, are just trying to, this is not stopping. This will happen, but it's always interesting to hear that people's response to change is to try to hold on to the past.
Well, they're vested interests. The dairy industry in this country is not in the best of shape. We sit on mountains of cheese and we keep on producing cheese. The consumption of milk falls every year. And so when the dairy people see something like oat milk or soy milk and see the word milk on the container, that just drives them nuts. And they are not winning in court. And probably the states that are enacting the anti-meat will probably be overturned in the courts.
Speaking of losing customers, one of my favorite trends that you keep highlighting are the non-food businesses siphoning off restaurant customers. Restaurants are just in trouble. But a couple years ago, you talked about cafes in marquee flagship stores, like Ralph Lauren opened up the Polo Bar. This is an evolution of that, and I love that you touched on it and bring it up because it's interesting to see how people are trying to have this third place and have continued to capture customers. So what's changed from what we talked about in the past?
One of the liabilities of being in the restaurant business is that it's a very easy business to get into. Having said that, one of the problems facing the retail industry is that people are abandoning their stores in droves because you can shop at home and with a couple of clicks. So a lot of retail ventures are adding food to things like department stores and specialty stores and adding coffee shops and third places, as you said, in order to provide a reason for somebody to come to a Ralph Lauren with a Polo restaurant. It's getting more interesting than that. There are a group of cinemas around the country, Nighthawk Cinema being one, we have one here in Brooklyn, the Alamo Draft House, that are actually building restaurants into the cinemas, and they're providing the equivalent of room service to your seats. So the idea is that you can have a dinner and a movie without going out to first a dinner and then a movie, but you can do it all in the same place. And that's sucking away business from traditional restaurants.
And how is the food quality? This is what I always come back to, is how is the food quality of these endeavors? Are they held to the same standards as if you were to go out to a restaurant, say Roberta's? Is the quality fine? And it's a little bit, you're like, well, I'm doing this, so I have this other thing. It kind of solves the thing. Where does it lie in that? And what standards do they tend to hold themselves to?
Well, the food's kind of okay. And if you've had a hamburger or a bucket of fried chicken delivered to your seat in the movie theater, and you're watching a good movie, you probably won't pay too much attention to the quality. But it's not just movie theaters. AT&T opened a space in Seattle where you can use it as if you would a Starbucks. You can come in, sit down, go online, order a phone if you want to or not, but they're exposing you to the AT&T market. And the most interesting one to me is one of the bank companies that's pretty aggressive in this area, and they've opened several banks in places that used to be banks but don't need to be anymore because there's six ATM machines take the place of most of what the banking functions are. But you can come into the bank and there is a guy who will make a mortgage for you, or you can just do your banking. But you can sit and go to a coffee bar and have a croissant and coffee or a sandwich and coffee and open up your laptop. And it's like the Ace Hotel without a hotel. So because it's easy to get into this food business, we're seeing more and more people using food as a way to get people onto the premises and keep them there. By the way, it's impossible for a restaurant to start a bank.
Right. So it just further encroaches on the, you know, thin margins of restaurants.
Correct.
We're going to go into my favorite part of the trend show, the buzzwords. There's a lot of them this year. Some of them I don't know. We'll start it off. We're just going to go all over this. For those who have it, we can follow along. Let's go for Kalamondin.
Kalamondin is a very sour citrus fruit from Southeast Asia. You find it in the same places we were talking about before. You find it in Philippine cuisine, where it's a souring agent, and you find it in what used to be called Indochina. You will see it on menu. Sometimes it's called calamansi, sometimes it's called calamondin, and it's generally in upscale places. But we're seeing more of it.
Oat milk craze. Can't keep it stocked to the Whole Foods. It's insane.
Don't ask me why.
I can tell. It tastes delicious. I think that's why. I think it's the first non-dairy milk that actually tastes good.
And it also has the psychological advantage that oats are good for you even before you picked up the container of oat milk. It's really sweeping away a lot of other milk substitutes.
Duck and chicken liver preparations in restaurants that people trust. Was that happening in places where people didn't trust?
No. You really have to trust somebody in a restaurant with a good chef to serve you things like liver or other organ meats. At the same time, most people who order those are self-selecting in terms of the restaurants that they choose to patronize. So it's a class thing too.
Kachapuri catching on?
Which one?
Kachapuri.
Oh, Kachapuri. You know, I should explain what Kachapuri is.
Please.
It's a form of calzone, except that it's open on the top, and it's shaped like your bedroom slipper. Or put it another way around, it looks like an oversized Danish pastry, but it's not filled with sweet stuff. It's filled with cheeses and meats. And it's largely a Turkish dish. I saw it first in Australia about a dozen years ago. And, you know, you asked me last year, how do I keep track of these trends? And I said, you find something and you stick it in a file and watch. So
you saw this how many years ago?
About a dozen.
Okay.
You have to have patience to be a forecaster. It's eye-catching. You can eat it with a knife and fork, or you can pick it up like a big slice of pizza. Because it's eye-catching, it's suddenly catching on in fast casual places and casual restaurants. I haven't seen it in TGI Fridays yet, but it's coming.
TGI Fridays might not be around for much longer, according to your trends. Asian pastry/sandwich shops.
Yeah. We have several in New York. There's a flock of Korean pastry sandwich shops in around Atlanta for some reason. And there's a vast amount of them in San Gabriel outside Los Angeles, where there's a big slew of Chinese restaurants. They are going after two markets. They're going after the people who want a snack or a sandwich and are tired of ham and cheese. And they're going after people who want a dessert and snack and coffee. The sandwich that's lighting everybody up this year is called katsu, which is nothing more than a chicken cutlet or a meat cutlet with panko breading.
But it's that presentation with the no crusts, and it looks really good on Instagram.
And it goes on a slice of very fluffy bread with no crust, and a piquant kind of dressing and a bit of slaw. And it became the rage because somebody in London and a couple of people in the U.S. were selling filet mignon or Wagyu beef katsu sandwiches for $180 a throw. Well, okay, a lot of people don't go out every day for a $180 katsu meat sandwich, but it put the concept on the map.
Hard seltzer.
Hard seltzer, yes. there's been a dramatic drop in the number of people who are buying sodas, specifically colas. So if you walk through your supermarket today, you will find a completely different population on the soda shelves than you would have seen 5 years ago, with all kinds of flavored waters and waters with vitamins and waters with even CBD now, even cannabis waters. And among all of this is something called hard seltzer. It's got the alcohol equivalent of, say, a light beer. So instead of getting strawberry-flavored seltzer, or lime-flavored seltzer, which is really rather vile, you can now get it with some alcohol. but it's catching on. The reason, as I said, is because people have been marching away from colas.
We have hemp and cannabis and cocktails, soft drinks, beers, and everywhere else.
Yeah, we do. The floodgates are opening. So this will probably be the next economic bubble because everybody is piling into the cannabis business. The valuations of cannabis growing companies in Canada doubles and triples. Our big beer companies are buying into them or buying them entirely because beer sales are dropping. Guess what? That beer sales are dropping the way cola sales are dropping because the next generation of drinkers is less interested in beer. Actually, all alcohol sales are slowing down, but beer in particular. So the way the meat companies are investing in cellular grown meat and vegetable substitutes for meat, the beverage companies are investing in cannabis. So we're seeing it in everything. I haven't seen it in underarm deodorant yet, but we'll probably get there.
Probably, just like any type of cream, lotion, whatever. We give our dog CBD oil.
And what does the dog say about this?
We gave her CBD oil in a hotel room, and she, I'm not kidding, trashed the minibar and ate the minibar.
The entire minibar.
Just like a human. The final thing I want to touch on, which I think is the most impressive and important, is the rise of the chef activist. Jose Andres is a great example of feeding people in Puerto Rico and bringing attention. He's now nominated for Nobel Peace Prize. Why do you think people listen to chefs more than anybody else?
Well, chefs are more intimately connected with food than all the rest of us. Chefs make a living by doing a good job feeding people. And I think that there's been a growing awareness for 2 or 3 decades about the degradation of the food that we've been eating in this country since the Second World War. And we're now at a point where I think a lot of people have subconsciously a guilty conscience, especially chefs, regarding the kind of food that they've been serving for decades and decades. And because they're so close to food, I think the awareness factor is more acute in the restaurant world than anywhere else, especially when you look at the discrepancy between incomes and how people on the lower end of the income scale are forced to eat. And you know, Donald Trump hasn't has been an impetus behind some of this too. The idea that you're feeding people has been expanded to the fact that you're feeding the world. And there's a conscience that comes along with that, and a desire, let's say, to maybe right some wrongs that have been committed.
That is beautiful. We're going to leave it at that. Michael, thank you so much. Where can people find the Trend Report? How can they get in touch with you? How can they read last year's Trend Report? See how consistent you've been? Where can they go?
Oh, you can't find me. You Google Michael Whiteman, restaurant consultant, and 5 million citations will pop up.
But where can they find the Trend Report?
That's the easiest way.
Oh, okay. That is the easiest way. Great. Well, thank you for coming by. Jeet, welcome back. It's good to have you here. We're looking forward to another season and another year of Snacky Tunes. Tune in next week. We'll be back with an all-new live episode here on heritageradionetwork.org. Thanks for listening.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.